Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 2nd of June. Monday at 9 means all things political. We may be coming down to the end of the nomination for the Democratic presidential candidate. Then again, we may not be coming down to the end of this. We have a lot to talk about today. The huge win by Senator Clinton in Puerto Rico, what that means. The Democratic National Committee's special meeting to decide whether to seat Florida and Michigan's delegations, which turned into a pretty raucous affair by the end of it. The noise that people were making at the end was, according to a report from Time magazine, the sound of the Democratic Party fracturing, one-third for Obama cheering, one-third for Clinton booing, and the rest, including the chagrined members of the panel, frantically hushing both sides as if to say, don't go there. Don't show the Republicans how dysfunctional we are. This morning's New York Times says that in a telephone interview on Sunday from San Juan, Mrs. Clinton still raised the possibility that she would challenge the party's decision on Saturday on seating the delegates from Michigan and Florida. We're going to look at that and make a determination at some point, she said, but I haven't made any decision at this time. We also have primaries tomorrow, and that'll be the end of the primaries, if you can believe it. We will be talking with a guest from Montana, where one of the primaries will be held, and South Dakota. We'll be looking at the superdelegate-delegate count, which is a little bit different depending on what source you're looking at. And we'll, of course, be taking your phone calls, and I know that we'll have many of them during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you would like to join us by email, that address is talk@wpr.org. We have two guests with us this hour, Professor Alexander Lamas, who's been here several times before, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Professor Lamas, thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.
And also joining us is Professor Christopher Musty, Assistant Professor, Political Science Department at the University of Montana. Professor Musty, thank you so much for being with us.
No, I'm happy to be here, Kathleen.
Let's start with Saturday and start with you, Professor Lamas. This was quite a show. It was pretty raucous, wasn't it?
Well, that's right. Emotions are running high as we're getting to the end of the process. But I don't think spirit in the room really reflects what is happening now. I mean, that was a sensible compromise reached on Saturday, and we're moving forward.
Mm-hmm. What is happening now?
Well, as you said, the delegate selection process ends tomorrow with those final two primaries. And when you add up the numbers, it's really almost impossible to see how Senator Clinton can win on the basis of adding the pledge delegates and the super delegates. As before, you count in Puerto Rico, Obama had 2,055, and Senator Clinton had 1,880. And then, basically, if you factor in what's going to happen here tomorrow and Puerto Rico, Senator Obama is going to be 20 superdelegates away from the nomination on Tuesday night. And there's rumor that he has several dozen superdelegates ready to come out for him any time. Mm-hmm. And so I think if it's not Tuesday night, it's Wednesday morning or later in the week, all the tabulations are going to show that he has a majority of the delegates at the convention.
Professor Musty, do you think what happened in Washington at the Democratic National Committee special meeting was fair? Was it a fair solution?
Well, I think the committee and the entire DNC was put in a very difficult spot since Florida and Michigan both violated the very clear rules that the DNC had established. The DNC was in a tough position. Does it let every single state that wants to move their primary up to the front and engage in a mass front-loading exercise? Does it allow them to have all their delegates, or does it punish them? And I think the initial solution the DNC hit upon, of requesting the candidates not to campaign in those states and not giving those states any delegates was pretty draconian. And so I think based on that, this does, as Professor Lamas said, represent a very good compromise. It's not going to satisfy anybody, though. Certainly the voters in Michigan and Florida, probably at least many of them, feel like their votes don't count as much as they should. But on the other hand, their state leaders decided to violate the rules of the Democratic Party. Now, on the Republican side, several states did the same thing, and the Republicans penalized them by giving them only half the number of delegates that they normally would, which if the Democrats had done that initially and allowed the candidates to campaign, might have resulted in a smoother situation. But I agree that this is a compromise that hopefully, from their point of view, the Democrats can live with, and certainly there doesn't seem to be any other kind of solution, at least this year, that is workable at this point.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just the press centering on women who were Clinton supporters who were extremely angry and quite noisy. There was a lot of noise at the end of that session. What do you make of this comment, "Don't go there, don't show the Republicans how dysfunctional we are"? It certainly was visible on television that, you know, there wasn't a lot of party unity coming out of Saturday.
Well, I think it's a long way from early January when we had our first primaries to today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the distance, not just in the places all of the candidates have gone and the time that's elapsed has really worn through what was a very high degree of civility and a high degree of unity within the Democratic Party. If you remember back in January and February, a lot of us were talking about the seeming calm on the Democratic side compared to the raucous debates on the Republican side. And I think we've now seen that with the campaign dragging on this long, that the Democrats are really starting to feel a strain, and that the supporters of both candidates are you know, very tense. And you know, this would not be happening if the stakes weren't so high. If Hillary Clinton were behind Barack Obama by 500 delegates, or if the Democratic Party had a system like the Republican Party, which is predominantly winner-take-all primaries,
mm-hmm.
then this would have been over
mm-hmm.
a long time ago. So, I mean, in one sense, this is a big problem for the Democrats. There's a split, but it's frankly no secret that over time the Democratic Party has been a party much more comprised of coalitions in tension than the Republican Party. And so I don't think it's a real surprise to the Republicans to think that the Democrats may have some patching up to do before the general election begins.
What do you think, Professor Lamas, about her huge win in Puerto Rico and her comments that she this morning quoted in the Times that she may go on here? She's not real happy with the Michigan and Florida delegation results. She won huge in Puerto Rico, and this isn't it.
Well, I think you know, she hoping for a miracle, and the votes haven't been cast in the last two primaries, so she's not ready to concede, you know, now. But I think it's going to look very different in a few days, and that's how I read it. I listened very carefully to Harold Ickes on Meet the Press yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and I think if you read between the lines of what he was saying, it's pretty clear that even though the words weren't there, that they understand that they've lost this nomination fight.
Mm-hmm. Professor Musty, we've had a hard time finding polls from South Dakota. The latest we got from a search this morning was from April, actually, and it shows Obama with 46, Clinton 34, undecided 10, no one 6, other 4. Are those polls pretty much what you would say they are today going into tomorrow's race?
In South Dakota?
Uh-huh.
I would say that probably one of the things that we've seen in states where there has been a lot of polling is that the numbers have been relatively stable, at least since March, that none of the big events that have happened in the campaign, whether victories by one candidate or the other or missteps or problems that they've had to deal with, none of them seem to have moved the poll numbers very much. What seems to move the poll numbers is the candidates campaigning fairly heavily in the states, and even then the numbers haven't changed enormously. So I wouldn't expect the results from South Dakota to be very different from that tomorrow. In addition, in Montana, we had a poll done just a couple of weeks ago by the Lee Newspaper Group, And they found that Obama led Clinton 52 to 35. Now, I would expect that to tighten up somewhat, but it's a pretty huge gap for Clinton to try to close. And even if she does close it, and in fact it ends up being a tie in both states and the delegates are awarded commensurately, she's still, again, behind by over 100 delegates. And if those superdelegates break towards Obama, then I think that's the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have, you know, these two last contests
right.
to deal with. And I think that it's, you know, part of Clinton's strategy has been to say, look, let's play this out. You know, this is very close. She's right in saying that this is a historically close primary contest for the Democrats. And so that there's, you know, there are strong arguments to be made in spite of the whatever conflicts it causes within the party, that she has absolutely earned the right to continue on through the primary season.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, what do you make of all of this? It is, to me, still rather astounding. It was a given that she was going to be the nominee not that long ago. Her opponent is a gentleman who's beautifully well-spoken, who doesn't have as much experience as she did, who was relatively unknown. And it looks as though he's going to capture the nomination. It is quite a story, I think. How did it happen?
Well, I agree with you. It's an astounding story. And, you know, Senator Clinton herself in December, late December, on one of the Sunday programs this week with George Stephanopoulos, said it'll be over by February 5th. I mean, that's a direct mm-hmm. quote. And that was her strategy, was to take advantage of the front loading of the process and the fact that she was so much better known than Senator Obama and even some of the others, and was way ahead in the polls last year, and wrap it up by then. And what she didn't understand, I think, was the personal characteristics that Obama brought to this campaign and that resonated in the Democratic electorate. And so he is a phenomenon, really, and on the order of, I think, with the of a John Kennedy, bringing that kind of charisma and personal magnetism.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Professor Mustard?
I would agree. I think that can't be understated that Obama has been a very strong candidate, and I think that his message has resonated with a lot of people who have not voted in the past in Democratic primaries. And one of the things that we've seen, especially on the Democratic side and to a lesser extent on the Republican side, is much higher turnout this year. And so, you know, clearly Obama has energized a large group of primarily but not exclusively younger voters who've come into the party or have been waiting for somebody to really inspire them. On the other hand, I think that Senator Clinton, to her credit, was trying to run a fairly straightforward, cautious campaign to reassure people who had concerns about what kind of president she might be like, what kind of policy she might follow. So she was, I think, trying to sort of come across as a very straightforward candidate with solid policy credentials and trying not to sort of raise whatever negative impressions people had of her from her time as First Lady and from her service as senator. And so I think she ran a campaign that was in some ways more cautious and not focused on as being as inspirational or as sort of electric. And I think that created a bit of a space for Obama or a candidate like Obama to come in and to really sort of motivate people who were either not inspired by Senator Clinton or didn't feel like her policies were really appealing to them, or for whatever reason felt like she had some personal baggage that she had to overcome.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is something, and maybe I'm overstating this, tell me if I am, but there is something about the words. There's something about listening to one of his speeches, and it's been criticized, he has been, for just being a guy who gives speeches. She's criticized him for that. But I got to tell you, those speeches have moved so many people. Maybe what we're in need of now is some strong inspiration.
Well, that always helps in politics, that's for sure. And but I think Senator Obama, you know, brings more than just well-crafted speeches. He makes the argument, of course, that he had the right judgment on the Iraq War.
Yes,
opposing it before the vote was taken in the Senate, even though, of course, he didn't vote on it. But it is amazing, and of course, for it to be of enormous historical importance, he's going to have to win the election, and then we turn to what type of president he will be,
and I don't know
how that'll play out.
I'm sorry. I think the primaries, even though it's taken a long time to get to this point, have sort of played into Obama's strengths, which are that he's been able to go from state to state to state and be very compelling in giving some of his speeches, but that the press and his opponents haven't really honed in on what they perceive of as either problems with policy or President Clinton hasn't really been able to make the case that his lack of experience is a severe problem, which is something that he'll run into in a much more concrete way if he gets the nomination and faces Senator McCain and criticisms from the Republicans and from 527 and other independent groups in the general election. So I think in some ways the fact that the primary election has gone on in the way that it does, or that it has given him some room to sort of play to that strength, to the speech-making. And one of the things that we've seen in Montana, which is extremely rare, is that we've seen multiple visits by both candidates. And the first time that Obama came to Montana, he was greeted by enormous crowds here in Missoula. The university's special events center, the Adams Center, was filled to capacity, and they had to put people in the football stadium.
Oh my.
But just last week, he was in Great Falls, a smaller city, but they have a 4,000-seat arena, and he only filled it about half full.
Oh.
So it's not clear why that is. It was graduation night, and there were other things going on in Great Falls, and Great Falls is not necessarily a place. It's somewhat more conservative than Missoula, so it may not be Barack Obama's strength.
Mm-hmm.
But one possibility is that that's due to sort of a sense of fatigue, that since he's giving primarily his broader stump speech in different places, that people in Montana felt like they'd heard it once, or they knew pretty much what he was going to say, and while interested in it, didn't want to take the time out to go to hear the speech in person.
Right. The problem that he has had, and I'd like for both of you to comment on this because I wonder where it will go in the campaign, is the pastor problem. And now we got another pastor. We got a Catholic priest who was a visiting pastor at Trinity, and that's all over the news over the weekend on Meet the Press. You know, they play that clip over and over. What does that say about him? What does that say about this being a huge issue in this campaign, and will it continue to be?
I think it's going to fade. Of course, he did resign from the church mm-hmm. over the weekend, and the latest flap over the Catholic priest is really very hard to pin on Obama. I mean, this was an invited priest, and that Obama has no control over that. Now, that some of the things that he said touch on some of the realities of the process. I think the funniest part of it, if you want to look at it that way, was when he mimicked Senator Clinton, saying that she thought she had it wrapped up.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that's true, But is that something that in good taste you want to present the way he did? I don't think so.
Right.
No, and I think it's going to be difficult to know just how this is going to play out. I think back to only 4 years ago, to the 2004 election, when I think the Democrats at this point in the campaign probably felt quite good. They had a nominee who had sewn up the nomination very early, and Kerry was clearly one of the stronger candidates, if not the strongest, in terms of foreign policy, both in terms of experience and also presenting a contrast to President Bush in terms of his service in Vietnam. But then we know what happened in July, which is that in August, which is that Senator Kerry was very strongly attacked by the Swift Boat group that sought to raise questions about his service in Vietnam. And so what appeared to be one of his strengths ended up being one of his weaknesses. So I think the sort of underlying problem with Senator Obama's church is that it may raise questions in people's minds about, well, what kind of a person is he in terms of his stated goal of bringing people together,
right,
and transcending some of the old divides. If these stories about Reverend Wright and the more recent speech in his church make people think, well, what kind of a uniter would he be, or does this really cause some questions about his capacity to do that as a president.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do that in just one moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Lots of political topics today with the Montana and South Dakota primaries tomorrow. Puerto Rico was took place on Sunday, and of course we had the Democratic National Committee's special meeting to decide whether to seat Florida and Michigan's delegations, and there was a bit of, well, bad feeling on the part, particularly I think of the Clinton supporters in the audience, that the committee was not going to go their way, and there was some shouting and on to Denver, and what does that do for party unity? So your thoughts on all of this, okay? We're getting down to the end, eh? 800-486-8655 is the number. Our guests are Professor Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, Professor Christopher Musty, Assistant Professor of Political Science in the department at the University of Montana. Oh, and our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, some of you may have seen the National Geographic special on Stonehenge last night or have read National Geographic's June issue, Secrets of Stonehenge. It's a fascinating look at why this place was built. And we will be talking with one of the archaeologists the second hour of our show today. Professor Christopher Musty, Assistant Professor, Political Science Department, University of Montana. Professor Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, our guests for all things political. And we go to phone calls now, gentlemen, starting with Jim from Appleton. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Jim.
And guests, there's been just a great deal of pressure on both candidates to name the other one as a vice presidential candidate, and presuming that Senator Obama does get the nomination, my suggestion would be that he tell her that if he is elected, he will appoint her to the Supreme Court at the first vacancy. And I think we can assume that there will be at least one during certainly 8 years, if not 4 years. And I think that would go a long way toward unifying the party. There was an excellent column, I think it was in the Washington Post in this regard, 2-3 weeks ago, laid out Hillary's qualifications for such a post, and they're outstanding. So I'd like to see what your guests thought of that and whether we shouldn't be promoting that.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. Professor Lamas?
Well, it's a neat idea. My guess would be that she really isn't interested in that position. I mean, she's clearly reaching for the superior political power, and you find that in executive offices. There's been mentioned that she might run for, you know, governor of New York in 2 years. That seems to me more appealing, might be more appealing to her than a Supreme Court position.
Professor Musty?
I have to agree. I would also think that it's the kind of thing that even if he were to offer and she were to seriously consider it, it might be difficult in terms of if not Senate confirmation, since from all I understand, Senator Clinton has very good relations with her Senate colleagues, so they might not object to the idea of her being president, so the confirmation process might go well. But it might, you know, to the extent that Senator Clinton is perceived as a divisive figure, it might be perceived too much as a quid pro quo for her dropping out of the race at this point. And certainly, if Obama were president and were nominating Senator Clinton for the Supreme Court, he would take a lot of flack and probably lose some political capital for doing that. Now, having said that, I think there will be some serious discussions between the two of them about what kind of role she might play.
Oh, yeah.
But I also understand that there's a fair amount of bad feeling between the two campaigns themselves at this time, and so it may not be very easy for them to negotiate some kind of solution.
Well, what do you think about that? Do you think that he will offer her, just because he knows it would probably be a winning ticket and to placate all the many, many Hillary supporters in this country, do you think that he is getting pressure to offer this to her? And would she say yes?
Well, absolutely. He's getting pressure. And it is an appealing ticket, I think, to a lot of people who are not emotionally committed to one side or the other. I mean, and it also is, as you suggested, a very practical solution. It's been done in the past. Presidential candidates have taken on people they aren't necessarily that comfortable with.
Kennedy and Johnson.
Kennedy and Johnson, mm-hmm. I think also Reagan and Bush, too. And in fact, you know, President Ford might have been well advised to have taken Ronald Reagan on the ticket in 76. It may have made a difference for him in a close election. So I think that's certainly going to be the big question. And I just have no idea where he's going to go. I think there are a number of other candidates. I think there are several strong women candidates who might very well get the nod. I think that making if he doesn't go with Senator Clinton, giving it to a Democratic woman would be a smart choice.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, and I also think sort of the normal thinking that political scientists go through, and even more intensively that candidates go through, is what's going to help my ticket. And clearly, I think it would help to patch up the party if Senator Clinton were the vice presidential nominee. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that she'd be that interested in it, and I think it would cause another problem with the ticket, or actually two problems, one of which is that both Clinton and Obama are senators. And it's fairly clear that historically it's been difficult to win running from the Senate. Now, this year, since either whoever wins the Democratic nomination will be a senator, and McCain is obviously a senator, we're going to have a president who is a senator. But I'm sure that both McCain and Obama are thinking about, is there a governor out there, someone with executive experience at the state level, who I can nominate? And I think that's one of the reasons why some of the Democratic female governors in the country, for example, Janet Napolitano of Arizona, have been promoted as a potentially very good running mate for Obama. She also brings regional diversity. You know, since Obama is from Illinois, a traditionally Democratic state, and Clinton is from New York, a traditionally Democratic state in Democratic regions, it might be better for him to choose someone from a different region.
Hmm.
I'm just going to interject. Another woman governor, of course, is Kathleen Sebelius of Kansas.
Right.
Yes.
And there's an interesting side note to her story that's probably not widely known, that she's the daughter of a former governor of Ohio, Jack Gilligan.
Oh, right.
Grew up in Cincinnati, so it wouldn't be bad for the ticket to have an Ohio native who's also a governor of Kansas.
And how, you know, I keep thinking that Jim Webb is a good guy for him to have as a VP. Do you think it's more important to have a strong woman than to have a guy who's strong on defense, who really has crossed party lines, who's very well spoken, he's an author, et cetera? What do you think of that?
I think certainly he brings strength, and there are other male candidates like Governor Richardson of New Mexico, and there's a, you know, an entire field. I've latched onto this notion of a woman VP simply because so many women are emotionally invested
yes,
in the idea of
right.
a woman president, or at least someone, you know, very close to the presidency.
I would think the problem with Webb, other than the fact that he's a senator, so you've got the two senator problems, is also the fact that he was only elected in 2006. So he's not got as much Senate experience. Obviously, he's got experience in the administration, which would be a boon to Obama. But in terms of sort of Senate experience, he and Obama both have fairly limited experience, and I think that could play against the choice of Webb as a running mate for Obama.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Sally from Middleton is next. Hi, Sally.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, things are getting finally kind of exciting. Well, they've been
finally
interesting the whole time, I think.
Right.
Very unusual. I'm with you, Kathleen. I think this is an amazing election. I'm amazed, and I guess it's, I don't know whose fault it is, but how many, many people are still saying, what was he done? He's so young. He hasn't, let him have some more years and prove himself. He's just been a senator for one term, and, you know, they don't know that he's taught constitutional law for 10 years at University of Chicago. He was not only went to Harvard, but he was elected to the Harvard Crimson paper, and then elected to be the editor. Everything he's done has been outstanding. He's done volunteer work. He's He's done good work in the Illinois Senate. Is why they gave him the speech to deliver on in the Democratic Convention 4 years ago. I think when you do listen, people say, "Oh, well, he can give good speeches." Well, listen to the content. This is a guy that thinks. I mean, we don't get this kind of quality that often in American politics. Usually, we, not that we don't have good people, but either they've run a clothing store in Truman in Missouri, or I mean, this is an unusually able guy. But why don't people know that,
Professor Musty?
Well, I think that a fair number of people do know that. That I think if he hadn't done a fairly good job, especially early on in the campaign, of introducing himself not just as someone who can give good speeches and someone who's in favor of change and, as he says, trying to change the political culture of Washington, I think if he hadn't also made the argument that if he didn't have national long-running political credentials, that at least he had other credentials that made you think that he was somebody who could step into the presidency and do a good job. So I think the fact that he'd gone to Harvard Law School and edited the Law Review and his experience as an organizer in Chicago and as a member of the legislature in Illinois, I think all those things did get out there well enough so that people sort of got over the big question of whether or not he's someone they should take seriously as a candidate, and I think that enabled him to make the argument that he would be an agent of change. But I think that's a double-edged sword, and he's going to have to face, I think, in the general election, much more tough questions about, especially because he's running against someone in McCain who's had a long tenure in the Senate and has some major legislative achievements like the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that he can point to and say, look, this is what I've accomplished, and Senator Obama, what have you accomplished? So I think it's not an unreasonable concern for people to have. I think so far Obama has done a very good job of explaining why it's not such a big concern, but I think it's a question that even many of Obama's supporters still have about him.
Thanks very much for the call. We have an email from Chris from Shorewood. Recent polls in a number of states show that the strongest Democratic ticket against McCain and any potential VP is Obama Edwards. Senator Edwards sets the standards for all comers in this race. Is he under consideration, do you think, or not?
I imagine that he will be under consideration, but I think since he's done it once, that would
right.
probably not be something that he will go for, if offered.
And we're looking at some AP polls here from the end of May showing favorability ratings, which look at Senator Clinton with a pretty low favorability rating, 29%, 50% gave her an unfavorable rating, Obama 41%, 46% for McCain. Is this McCain territory, Professor Musty? Is he in all likelihood going to win Montana and South Dakota?
Well, both Montana and South Dakota have traditionally gone Republican in presidential races, at least in the last 30 or 40 years. So even though Bill Clinton won Montana in 1992, that was primarily because the large Republican vote here was split between President Bush and Ross Perot. So our current polls show that McCain is ahead of Obama by about 8 points and would be ahead of Clinton by about 11 points, which, given this state in the campaign, is not that huge a lead.
Mm.
So it's conceivable that Obama could defeat McCain in Montana. But Montanans, at least in the last 30 to 40 years, have had a strong propensity to favor the Republican nominee.
Yeah. You know, though, gentlemen, let's talk about where the Republicans find themselves right now. This is just not a good time for them. We have a war that people just don't like at all. We have gas prices here at $4.10 a gallon. The economy is going down the tanks. You can't sell a house. It's just not a good time for Republicans, is it?
No, it isn't. And I think the strongest argument Senator Obama makes is if you elect Senator McCain, you're bringing on the third Bush term, and that is you know another reason why this Democratic nomination was so vigorously fought over and brought in so many candidates at the beginning. It is clearly a Democratic year. Now, if it turns out that that Obama loses a close election, people are clearly going to look closely at the issue of racial prejudice. And I think that is the a key theme running through not only the primaries but coming up in the general election, which brings us to the analogy of 1960. It was an enormous amount of anti-Catholic bias in that election. We know that there were millions of people who were Protestants who would have been expected to vote Democratic who didn't vote Democratic, who voted Republican. Kennedy was able to win, and in many analyses, it was surprising how close that election was, given the things that were going in the favor of Democrats in 1960. So I think we're going to see that there are going to be millions of white voters who would have voted Democratic, I think, who are not going to vote for the first African American president.
Really? Do you think so?
Without doubt. I mean, uh-huh. I think that's the message out of the Ohio and Pennsylvania primaries and so forth. I'm hoping it will not be many millions, but I think it will be offset, however, by a lot of other people, a lot of other white people who see this as a great opportunity to move beyond the racial conflicts of the past.
Right.
And just as we got past the anti-Catholic bias in 1960, we have the potential in 2008 getting past this barrier. You remember Kennedy very eloquently said, do you voters want to tell 40 million Catholics in America that you lost your right to be president the day you were baptized? And I think, you know, Senator Obama at some point is going to may say that. I think he's been reluctant to bring those issues to the fore, but he may say that. Do you want to tell 13% of the population who are African American that you cannot be president because you're African American?
Right. And he's also half white. He's got that narrative as well.
That's true. Of course, but he chose to identify as African American.
Right. It is a big thing. That is a big thing in this country. I'm astounded by that. We have an African American candidate who could become president. That is huge.
Well, it's huge in the world.
I'm sure you picked up
commentary. You know, I heard President Carter say on television not too long ago that everywhere he goes in the so-called third world, people are quite excited, and they ask him, is it really possible that America, with its history of racial discrimination, can do this? And so I think there are a lot of voters who want to see that message sent.
Cliff from Appleton, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if either of you were aware of a story that's been circulating on the Internet for some time, which was finally vetted and published in the latest Vanity Fair magazine about President Bill Clinton's recent philanderings that make his prior dealings with Monica Lewinsky look like adolescent play. He's been reported to be risk-taking since his heart surgery, associating with some unsavory characters, and taking trips on a plane which they've nicknamed the F-word plane. If Michelle Obama can be scrutinized for saying she's finally really proud to be an American, certainly Bill Clinton can be scrutinized for his alleged debauchery, and Hillary's reaction to her husband's ongoing womanizings needs to be explored. You know, this is a legitimate bombshell, and it deserves more media exposure. You know, scrutinizing Obama's pastor, let's scrutinize Hillary's husband.
Professor Musty, give that one to you.
Oh, thank you. I've not read the Vanity Fair article. I know that Clinton has been, at least in Montana, he's been here often enough that, and followed closely enough by the press, that I would be surprised if there was much more, or much that was going to come out about that. Although, again, as I said, I haven't read the Vanity Fair article. I don't know what the allegations are exactly. But I think one of the things that's going to be interesting about this election is that, so far in the primary, we've seen some scrutiny of both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama. In the general election, I'm sure that some of the 527 and other organizations are planning to run very tough campaigns and very nasty commercials against candidates on both sides. But I would say that probably the mainstream press is going to tread very cautiously, as they have so far this year, about focusing on personal scandal. And one reason for that is that I think a lot of the public, when asked about what they think about the news media coverage of the campaigns, tends to want to know a fair amount about the candidates, but more about how they would govern if they were elected, and what their policies are and how they're conducting themselves as candidates. And I think that, well, obviously the Reverend Wright situation hurt Obama. I think there's also a sense among the electorate that is evident in the fact that the polls haven't changed that much, that people are somewhat reluctant to look at the associations of the candidates and to hold them responsible for everything that their associates and even their spouses do.
Mm.
So I don't think that even if this comes out as something that is covered more intensively in the mainstream press, I don't think it's really going to cause a problem for Senator Clinton's campaign. We're five months from the first contests in Iowa and New Hampshire, and so far that hasn't blown up. So I think that we will see some dirty campaigning from here to the end of the general election in November, but I don't think there's as much taste for it or willingness to pay attention to it as there has been in the past.
Is it an issue? He's not really running for president, Professor Lamas.
Well, that's right, and since, as I said, I think Senator Obama will be the presumptive nominee very shortly, that it really won't be an issue. Now, if she is the VP, of course, it may resonate.
Yes.
I had not heard the rumors either.
So everybody goes to Vanity Fair this afternoon, right? And see that happening. We'll all go to the Internet. We need to pause for a moment and return and take more phone calls. All things political for this Monday, the 2nd of June. It could be the week that the Democratic nominee for president will be announced. We have two guests with us, Professor Alexander Lamas, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University, Professor Christopher Musty, Assistant Professor, Political Science Department at the University of Montana. Of course, there are only two states remaining with their primaries, Montana and South Dakota, both taking place tomorrow. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. No, we don't, but we might in a moment. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Monday, we'll speak with an archaeologist from England who's been heavily involved in the latest excavations at Stonehenge. It was a fascinating article, and, well, that it's on the cover of National Geographic, and then they had a documentary last night that was well done as well. So that's coming up hour two. All right, let's go back to phone calls, and we go to Tom from Milwaukee next. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for letting me insert my views here.
Sure.
I think this thing, I've been watching this right from the beginning, and I've had a very open mind about it. I'm a voting Democrat. I think this whole thing is becoming more and more about November, and it's becoming more and more about electability, and it's becoming increasingly about durability, not only of message, but of candidate tenacity. And I think that's why Senator Clinton has a developing edge here. I believe that what the American public is looking for is, among above all other things, leadership. We've been flim-flammed and misled for so long by rhetoric from Washington, from both our president and our VP. I think that increasingly the perception is, as mine is at least, that Senator Obama, while he has very interesting things to say and a strong philosophical approach to the candidacy, is far too much focused on, and this bothers me, on the rhetoric of politics as opposed to the substance of politics. I see substance in Senator Clinton. And by the way, as far as the rumorism is concerned, that comes along every election. Bill is not running. Hillary is. What bothers me, though, about November is that in its search for leadership, I think the American voting public is going to increasingly look for those qualities of toughness and leadership. And if Senator McCain continues to build on the message that he is presenting of leadership and toughness, a father figure, I can see a lot of the electorate thinking, we got to go back to somebody who offers these strong qualities. Because we can't be content anymore with a strong rhetorician, with a strong message. We've been hearing that for 8 years. So for the Obama camp to say that it's in the bag, I think the voters are going to respond, wait a minute, we're not so sure. And I think that the electability concern is a great one for the Democratic National Committee, for the Credentials Committee. They are highly aware of this. I don't think anytime soon we're going to see this toughness leadership message that Senator Clinton presents go away.
Do you think she'll carry on then to Denver, Tom?
I certainly do. I have a strong feeling for that, and I think that that needs to be the underlining point that she's making with the American electorate right now.
Okay, thanks for your call. Professor Lamas.
Yes, I'm not sure how long she will carry on the campaign. I could see that she may want the symbolism of having her name put into nomination, having all those delegates vote for her, and then lose narrowly. I don't know that it'll go that way, but the caller raises an important issue that will be there in the fall, and that is the experience issue, and it's been, of course, it's been an issue in the campaign so far for the Democratic nomination. I think Senator Obama has a strong record. I think he's a person, if you followed closely what he's done and read his books as well as the one biography that is has been published on him, you see that he's been consumed with American domestic issues and policy in his lifetime. Again, I make an analogy to John Kennedy. I don't think it was widely appreciated how much of his early life was consumed with trying to understand foreign affairs. And at that moment in our history, foreign affairs clearly were very, very important. I mean, the Cold War raging and so forth. My guess is that it is domestic matters that will dominate in the minds of the voting public. Of course, foreign policy will be there as well. But I think Senator Obama is going to do as well as John Kennedy in overcoming the charge that he's not experienced enough.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add that I think that some of the polls that we've seen over the past six months have indicated that voters are becoming somewhat less concerned about foreign policy issues, including Iraq and the war on terrorism, and that domestic concerns, especially about the economy, are becoming much more salient. To that extent, I think that McCain's effort to focus on his own experience in foreign policy and to make a contrast with the Democratic nominee, especially if it's Obama, aren't going to resonate as strongly with a large portion of the electorate as they might have, say, 4 years or 8 years ago. I should say 4 years ago. I think the other thing to note is that neither Obama nor Clinton is, whoever emerges, and it clearly looks like it will be Obama, but whoever emerges with the Democratic nomination is going to have some baggage with them. I think the caller is right to identify this as one of the lingering questions about Obama. How much substance is there? How tough is he going to be? I think, however, that Senator Clinton also has baggage that's associated with her, which is one of the reasons why she began the campaign with fairly high negatives in terms of her favorability, unfavorability rating, and that those have actually increased as the campaign has gone on. So I don't think we're looking at a situation where it's totally cut and dried who's going to win the general election. But I think in terms of electability, I think that there's an argument to be made by both sides and that both candidates have made that argument. And while Senator Clinton's argument, as the caller expressed it, is a pretty strong one, time is really running out for her, and simply the fact that she hasn't won all of the vast majority of the delegates since mid-March, since she's been more strongly making that argument, I think indicates that Democratic voters still have questions about her that have overshadowed the questions that she's raised about Senator Obama and his ability to be a tough leader.
One more call in, about 1 minute left in the show, everybody. Larry, who's from North Carolina but traveling through Wisconsin. Hi, Larry.
Yes, I'm a retired sergeant major out of the Marine Corps, 24 years, and I have 2 points here. Is that I hear a lot of promises being made by the different candidates throughout the years. I'm 57 years old. Being in the military, I listen pretty strongly to them, too. And it's kind of like winning the lottery, and they're spending the money ahead of time on promises. Well, they talk about the lower income, the middle income, and the impact and the economy. So something I haven't heard talked about, but in my travels is starting to do this full time. I think approximate date, I think they're pretty correct, in December of 04, January and February of 05 was the last time diesel fuel was lower than regular fuel. If I'm not mistaken, diesel fuel is a byproduct of gasoline. It's actually cheaper to make. I never hear anything on the news about the immediate effects it would have on the truckers paying a lower price for diesel and how this would impact on the cost of food for some of the people that are less fortunate and that have to work for a minimum wage in these $10 and $11 an hour.
I need to hold you there. It's a good point. Just very, we need 5 seconds.
It's a major problem in the economy. I was talking to a trucker just the other day, and I brought that point home to me.
Yeah.
He parked his truck because the price of diesel is so high.
I know. It's a huge problem.
Yeah, he couldn't make it.
Mm. Gentlemen, thank you so much. It was a great hour, and it's an exciting week. Thanks.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Our guest, Professor Christopher Musty, Assistant Professor, Political Science Department at the University of Montana. Professor Alexander Lamis, who has joined us before, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, and thanks to Rhonda and to John Anderson for on-air production here in Milwaukee. We'll be back.